I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. It's Monday, 0103-00. The world is open for business, and we're still here. There was no real terrorism to speak of. There were no errant missiles, no nuclear meltdowns, no power failures, no planes falling out of the sky, no banking crisis, no story. But we dare to talk about nothing on The Connection. Well, maybe the story is the biggest non-crisis in 2,000 years. The Y2K hoax. Price tag $250 billion. The U.S. government spent $8.4 billion to fix glitches in computers that handle everything from Social Security checks to FAA air traffic control. Citibank spent $950 million on Y2K. Merrill Lynch dropped $520 million. But the real question is, was it a complete waste of time and money? Or was it one of civilization's finer hours, the world working diligently together in a warlike state of preparation to stave off a technological nightmare? Connection listeners, how are you feeling today? Relieved? Disappointed? Hungover on Y2K? We're talking about the Y2K mouse that never roared this hour. Our guests are Michael Dertouzos, who's director of MIT's Laboratory for Computer Science and the author of What Will Be? How the New World of Information Will Change Our Lives. Also from New York, the futurist Watts Wacker, author of The 500-Year Delta. Our connection phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK, the Y2K connection. Michael Dertouzos, welcome. You were not a Chicken Little, I want to say at the outset. What was the problem in hindsight? Or was there a problem at all?
Well, there was a bug created by computer people, and I'm a computer person, so I'll represent us and say we blew it. We created a bug starting in the 1960s and earlier, and we didn't think our programs would last. And we were looking at the future rather than at this turn of the century. I mean, no worse, if you wish, than 20th Century Fox naming itself 20th Century Fox. So we
still sounds better than 21st Century Fox.
We created a bug where we didn't anticipate this change. But then I think a couple of other factions joined in the game. And one of these, I would guess, is the media. And another one is the public at large. And the computer people, again, who came back as consultants to fix the bug.
You know, Michael and Christopher.
Watts Wacker, welcome.
Thank you, Christopher. Delighted to be back with you. I like to say when you think of the future that the only thing I know that's going to happen in the future is that an optimist has a pretty good one and a pessimist has a pretty crummy one. What I find interesting, though, is they do have the same things happen to them. And the pessimists, you know, lost to the optimists, although it's fun to note that John, you know, Koskinen, the Y2K czar, for those of your listeners who hadn't heard him over the course of the last year, predicted that today the stock market would drop 30%. So we still have at least today to look at.
Well, it's up 2%.
I think he's going to be a little wrong on that one, too, Michael.
Watts Wacker, what sort of a moment was it? In the long march into the future, this kind of constructed panic around the Y2K date problem.
Well, I think that the world paid attention. You know, the $250 billion in America has actually doubled. When I think you look at the world, it's probably $500 billion spent to make sure. Perhaps the biggest winner in all of this is Apple, because they were Y2K compliant from the beginning. So I hope they make some hay for themselves out of that. But I think the fact that the world paid attention shows that we can organize around issues that have communality for the world. And if anything, I think that we celebrated that communality. And actually, the world came together in a message of hope. I was very pleased and quite personally pleased to be a part of the world as we went into the new millennium.
My word, you're getting sentimental pretty early in the millennium, Watts.
I'm sorry?
You're getting sentimental pretty early in the millennium. A warm and fuzzy moment right here on
The
Connection.
Well, can I pick on this fuzzy moment and tell your listeners something they don't know? That you look like the Apostle Matthew, Chris Lydon.
You knew him personally?
I have a woodcut because I'm a Greek, so I go quite a bit back. And you look exactly like he does. And I think that makes you linked to the Y2K problem. Because if not for Christianity, it wouldn't be 2000.
You're going to blame Jesus for this.
I don't know if that's the person to blame or you and your links to Matthew.
Well, I'm humbled by the Matthew thing, but go ahead. What's Wacker?
Well, I mean, as you look at the datelines falling and so much of this country, I think, was watching what was going on as we went through Asia and Europe. You know, the Chinese, in effect, are acting like Westerners when they celebrated. And, of course, the Muslims were paying respects, not just, thumbing their nose. And I agree with what Michael says. This is kind of a triumph of the Christian spirit, whether it's Christianity, I think, is obviously up for debate. But
how do you get there?
Something that was playing to all of the world, and it seemed to have resonated all around the world.
Can we just go back to the computer thing? It seems to me that the problem may have been enormously exaggerated and maybe mm-hmm. even an illusion. I mean, it's much more, it seems to me, as if suddenly your car could go a whole lot faster and they have to add one more zero to your speedometer or something, and they did. However, it seems to me, for the computer world we all live in now, Watts, we are generally better armed for the future, are we not? It's as if this sort of fundamental network system that we all live with now was suspected of the worst. It's been checked to its toenails in every imaginable sort of way, and the computer industry And all of us as computer users are sort of more secure in a computer universe than we've ever been. Is that possible?
Well, can I take this?
Michael DeFrizo, please.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's only the fear of technology. I think that's one big component. I think this speaks a lot about human nature and the tendency of people toward apocalyptic events. I mean, if you look at these people in California who went and killed themselves because they were expecting a comet, I believe it was. And people want apocalyptic events. And here is a situation where there is no question that something was going to happen on January 1. So it kind of pinged at people's natural instincts, in addition to the fear of technology. So this says a lot about human nature.
I agree with Michael about the human nature component. I don't know if I agree with the entirety of the comments. If you use economics as a metaphor, Christopher and Michael, you know, Robert Rubin and Mr. Greenspan, the head of the Fed, will both tell you that no matter what, it comes down to the end to basic confidence. Do you feel confident in the future or do you not? And that economics comes to that conclusion and its end point. And I think technology can now have that same thing said about it. And the ability to have made it through this threshold, and I think everybody, even the naysayers, now recognize that we've made it through the threshold and that the Dow's not going to go down a zillion points today, it tends to rise the whole level of confidence into the future. I think the world is sitting, you know, at a precipice of kind of like 100 years ago, H.G. Wells wrote so eloquently about the, you know, people thought the world was going to end at the stroke of midnight from the 19th to the 20th century, and the derivation of the way a New Year's celebration is conducted today comes from that. And now that we've made it past, I think we're going to be more acceptant of change. And the fact that the technology didn't crash only adds to that.
Could I ask maybe Michael, there were places in the world where nobody did anything about Y2K, and nothing happened there either. Does that promote the case that the whole thing was a bit of a fraud?
Well, I don't know if I would go as far as to call it a fraud. First of all, let's keep in mind that if we look at the next 30 days, we might still have some difficulties. Let me just give you an example. Something that's date sensitive is the maintenance records of airlines. Now, they have been looked at very carefully for this bug. But if there is a date glitch, that's a place where it might strike, because they might think that something was maintained according to the computer just 2 days ago, when in fact it wasn't maintained for over a month. And this may result in a delayed problem. So we should not jump to the conclusion that we're completely out of this problem. What I said a year ago, and I'll say today, is that we may have a few very small, perhaps some bad situations develop, but the bulk of what will happen will be more in the direction of a nuisance. And I think the countries that didn't do anything about it kind of confirmed that. We still may hear of a couple of bad ones. But the bulk of
the ones we've heard of are so tiny as to be inconsequential. I mean, a few payroll checks apparently have been printed dated, January 2nd, 1900. So what?
Well, and that's exactly what led me to my earlier predictions that this wasn't going to be so bad, because I couldn't imagine any programs where the programmer said, you know, if the date is such and such, then lock the elevators in the down position and crash the airplane, or fire the missile, or stop the elevator, and so forth. Of course, it's the unexpected problems that we don't know, and that's why we shouldn't gloat too much. We still could have some
Michael DeTruzzo runs the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science, and I think it should be said that when 60 Minutes did its little survey of Y2K, he was the one sober head among the many experts who said, you know, keep your shirt on, we're going to get through this thing probably without anything happening. What about the media here?
That's the one I would hope you would handle, because there are these three contingents, and I'd like to hear about all three: the public, the media, and the computer geeks. What about the media, Chris?
Well, I don't know. Speaking for ourselves at the Connection, we were fascinated by the general idea of not only less with the computer thing, but with the sort of fin de siècle culture, what happens on the run-up to a great turn like this. And actually, we talked a lot about it 2-3 years ago and get kind of tired of it. And I must say, my sort of crap detector was sort of alerted by the eagerness of very, very spiffily dressed computer consultants to tell you you had a problem. And therefore, you ought to fork over a rather large sum of money to them to address it. I always was suspicious of this, and I got a lot of email from people saying, you're missing something here. You're going to be sorry you didn't get on the Y2K bandwagon when the world stops.
I think you're right on that, but coming back to the media, do you think the media acted more or less as the objective, neutral reporter of the truth, or were they instigators of the kind of ambiance of hyperventilation that came out of this business?
I don't think the media understood it well enough to take credit for hyperventilating.
I want to add my two cents on that one, too, Christopher and Michael. To the point that Michael made about apocalyptic influences on the zeitgeist, I think the media wanted to make sure that they gave full coverage. And one of the more interesting points just in general of how people are organizing our affairs into the future, I think, comes for me personally around looking at the role that paradox is playing in people's lives. And, you know, the pendulum of humanity is not the move from conservative to liberal. I like to remind people we don't have Republicans and Democrats. I think we have Remocrats and Dupublicans. But that was, of course, my attempt at humor there, Christopher.
Got it.
But the pendulum of humanity is the movement towards consensus, or the movement towards the exploration of endpoints. And we're in a world where we're clearly exploring the endpoints and apparently in a context with very little institutional guidance. And so I think the media felt that it was their role to talk about the extremes of how this could happen in both direction. And so you did see articles about people who were, you know, beyond cautious and were in effect fanatical about that this was going to be an apocalypse, and other people at the other end of the spectrum who were so laissez-faire, and as Michael said, countries that did nothing.
Who actually sort of forecast an apocalypse here?
Well, I remember, I'll just anecdotally answer, my minister yesterday came to me after the service and explained that a council of ministers in our community, I think there's like 25 or so, were brought together, and an executive who was from, I guess I can say it was IBM, was their speaker, and it was billed as a must come to, you can't miss this meeting of the clergy. And after they had their lunch and the guest speaker from IBM was about to begin, they closed all the doors so no one else could hear anything, you know, and all of the secret stuff started, you know, building in its anticipation. And he announced that under no uncertain terms that this would be a catastrophe.
Well, I think there were a few other catastrophes forecast. The collapse of the markets was forecast. A nuclear war was forecast. I remember well about a year and a half ago when I was doing my various predictions that there was nobody I could see that was predicting no trouble. Even in the 60 Minutes program you described, There were pictures and movies of people in the country building bunkers and storing supplies and all kinds of such panicky things. That's why I was asking you about the media, because it seemed to me, from my perspective, that more than 95% of the coverage was toward apocalyptic, catastrophic, devastating phenomena. I could be wrong in my remembering the event, but that's what I remember.
You know, and even more importantly than that, I think, Christopher, is that because of the media coverage of the potential of the catastrophe, you have mainstream institutions like the American Red Cross that puts out flyers of how to be prepared. And so they feed into it, and it feeds into itself. And if anything, I think that there was a collective holding of the breath and exhaling all around the world that is, if anything, nothing more than the embodiment of what it is to be alive.
And now, Connection listeners, what are you going to do with all that rye crisp? Seriously, 1-800-423-8255 makes the, now that we're really here, Y2K connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Stephen is on the line.
Thanks, Chris, for taking
Welcome, Stephen.
Call.
Glad we're all here.
You were talking about the hype in the media, you know, and I think that this whole thing looks more like one of our more shining hours than a lot of hype that went nowhere. I actually was a consultant and still am who helped fix some of these problems.
You're calling from the Bahamas?
No, my home.
Okay.
In any case...
Just joking.
No problem. The problem was there, and I think the problem was like trying to find a million needles in a haystack the size of the Rocky Mountains, and required a large number of people to go find them and remove them. And certainly some of the needles got missed, and we're hearing about the small ones that got missed and their impacts. But ultimately, without the hype, you never would have gotten the companies to spend the millions and billions of dollars to go find all those needles in that haystack. You need the hype. You need the burning platform to cause people to change what they're doing.
Michael D'Souza is shaking his wise head.
Well, I'm a Greek. You must remember that. And we spoke of the golden mean rule. And then we have throughout history, you know, a punishment that fits the crime and all that. So I would guess a certain degree of concern would be important. But are we going to ping the scales on everything? Because if we ping the scale on this one and it turned out to be, let's say, a problem of grade 5 or 6, and then later we have a problem of grade 9, what are we going to do? We may have a crying wolf syndrome here. So I think I agree with you, Stephen, that it was necessary to alert people, and I agree with a lot of what has happened out there. I'm not blaming anyone on this. I just wished that there was a little more golden mean rule applied here.
How would you apply it? What do you mean by that?
I mean that we should...
Moderation in all things.
Yeah, a little moderation. I think we should have gone out and looked at the problems, tried to avert the worst ones, but pinging the scales to this tremendous extent. Well, incidentally...
Stephen says it takes a certain kind of war panic to mobilize the resources that are necessary. Could that be right?
Well, I think he has a point. Question is, again, are we going to ping the scales for everything that happens? What happens if we have a far bigger, more real, more devastating catastrophe coming in the future?
Stephen?
Well, clearly there were people who took it to an extreme, right? I mean, there are people who built bunkers and loaded up on ammunition and just freeze-dried food and thousands of dollars in cash and gold. I mean, they were out of their minds, but... you know, I sell change for a living, and unless you can convince somebody that something bad's going to happen if they don't change, they won't.
Watts, you're the change guy. You want to comment?
Yeah, I do. And,
Stephen,
and
thank you.
The fact resides with that we could prepare. A lot of times catastrophes happen and you can't prepare. And if anything, part of... The demonstration for the future is that the world acted in concert against something that was known by all people to be an issue that should be addressed. I find some of the delicious things, like the fact that status was whether or not you had to work that night. You know, and of course, Lou Gerstner made a big deal out of having all of his people at IBM surrounding him and actually got, I think, kind of fun public, you know, relations play out of it. But if you had to work on New Year's Eve, you were considered that important to the security of the world that there was actually a status component.
It's an interesting point. You have this, I mean, $250 billion, that's and the end of a war, really, you have a huge army to demobilize now, or you have a huge army that's been trained up for computer programming at a very high level. What's the world going to do with these people? And what you read in the newspaper is that they're very much in demand.
Well, there's only 800,000 jobs for them open, even though they're already employed still.
Now, the computer business is the most rapidly rising business in the great future world.
It's a fabulous workout.
So don't worry about these people, Chris. Yeah. The consultants are going to be useful and valuable in other computers.
No, but it was, you know, as I said, it was sort of like a medical examination, or it was really like a kind of pre-military workout in which nobody got killed, nobody got shot, no bridges fell, and here we are, ready for a new century.
Well, I think I must agree with you that, and I agree with Watts, that this was a great example of global teamwork, and it speaks well for human nature and mankind. And I must say I'm relieved, too, that even the small, big, bad things that
you're
I forecasted...
You're just as smart as you thought you were.
I could have been wrong, you know. So, bottom line is there are a lot of lessons here, and I again go back to human nature.
1-800-423-8255, the real world of Y2K. It's here. It's safe. We're alive. The phone's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike is calling from a car phone.
Hi, Chris. It's a great show, and I commented that I'm a computer professional also, and although I don't pretend to understand the mainframe systems and so on that perhaps have had some of the bigger issues, but one of the things that you pointed out, which is that I think there was a lot of snake oil sold, although I'm not a Cliff Stoll fan per se, and that's primarily because of the small number of people that really understood what the problem was and how pervasive it was. Those people are paid enormous sums of money these days, and they are the only ones. And historically, in my opinion, the computer science profession has tended to play its cards very close to its vest, basically in a way of protecting their own jobs. And so I think that played into the media sphere and the public sphere, was the fact that they had only the information that was coming out of the computer science profession based their response on.
Mike, I think you got a point, but I'd like to take a little bit of an issue with you. I don't think anyone knew, really, the potential of this problem, and I speak for the computer scientists too, I think. These programs that were written back then and had permeated God knows where, they were all over in embedded computers, in elevators, in power plants, in automobiles. Nobody really knew or could trace where they were. As you know, in many cases, the source code was lost. So the bottom line in this was that no one really had a full knowledge of all the extent in which these various bugs were and what they might cause. And I think that was part of the problem itself. Now, there was a countermanding influence here, which was that even if they were in a lot of places, then how many places would be sensitive to date errors? But the first point I want to make is that no one really knew.
Well, I don't disagree with that statement at all. However, in my particular clients, The easy way was none of my clients were 24/7 operations. We just rolled everything forward and tested it.
Right.
And guess what? Nothing showed up, and I never found anything, although I will point out that the Naval Observatory's website at 3:03 referred to Eastern Standard Time in the year 19,100. That lasted for at least an hour or so. I wanted to underscore that mainframe systems, I'm only 39, and so I'm a little bit too young to have worked extensively there, although I was originally trained in it. And some of those are so large that it was a bit scary. But overall, I felt that the problems were not understood by many people, and it's lack of understanding of what the real danger is that tends to breed hysteria. That was what my real point was. I'm not by any means claiming that there weren't issues with many programs that were out there, but it was a lack of understanding that helped lead to the hysteria.
Mike, you're a sensible voice. Can I just want to ask a rude question though? What did you charge people for telling them that they didn't have or that the program could be sort of rolled forward, tested, and dismissed in a fashion.
Well, interestingly enough, the Wall Street Journal published an article, and I may be making a big mistake in timing, but about a year ago, and I believe it was either Newfoundland or Nova Scotia Electric Company, and I may have the exact name of the utility wrong, had been running on year 2000 time for a year or 18 months or so.
Hmm.
And they that's how they dealt with the problem. They said, with the exception of our connections to the national power grid, we as a utility are wholly running with all of our clocks set into, sometime in 2001. And I read that article in the Wall Street Journal 18 months ago and said, well, that's easy. Now, certain 24/7 operations, sure, it's very difficult to simulate the actual use of the systems. The stock market is a perfect example of that.
I was just meaning to be in a slightly nasty way, just to ask you, you know, did you make a killing on your good advice?
Not a cent. I had to work a little bit New Year's Eve, and quite frankly, the only reason I had to work is to make people feel comfortable. I made certain I never wanted to pretend that I would know for sure what would happen. I made sure that there were last minute backups made of data, and that.
Mike, I'm glad you were there. And if you were working New Year's Eve, you're a citizen of the new electronic millennium. And now we all are. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Magic Hour Communications, helping Fortune 1000 and fast-growing companies sell, market, and educate through videos, multimedia, websites, and presentations, magic-hour.com, and by PCs for Everyone, Windows 98, NT, and Linux-based computer systems and parts, building home PCs, corporate workstations, and servers, PCsForEveryone.com. I'm Christopher Light, and this is the Y2K Connection.
Mass destruction, plagues and famines, pestilence and power failures, atomic war and Satan's minions, yay, hip, hip, hip.
We're here, and so is Y2K.
Planes are smashing.
The phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Were you scared? Were you ever really scared? Where we had $250 billion worth of computer repairs and fine-tuning to avert the disaster that we never really got a good look at. 1-800-423-TALK with Michael Dutouzos, who runs the Laboratory for Computer Science at MIT, and the futurist Watts Wacker, author of The 500-Year Delta. Richard Landis joins us. He runs the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University. Try it again, Richard. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about a disaster that never happened.
You know, Christopher, this
Watts Wacker.
This is Watts. I think one of the most interesting things about Y2K is what comes now, which is the fact that we didn't have the disaster, is going to cause people to embrace technology faster, particularly ones who haven't yet. You know, a lot of the talking heads over the weekend made reference to how few people in the world are really online right now. I think this is going to cause a lot more people to get online a lot faster.
Well, I'd like to seize on that and agree with Watts. I think technology, first of all, is a daughter of humanity, and it's not different. I think most people are mistaken to consider humanism and humanity on one side and technology on the other. We created technology. The two got split during the Enlightenment, and that is the Enlightenment bug, which is much bigger than the Y2K bug. We used to be integrated before then, and we separated. We separated science from religion and from man and nature so that the things could pursue their own directions. And then the Industrial Revolution happened and we got rich. And now Y2K. But there was a time when technology was not separate from humanity.
This is interesting. I mean, you're talking about a kind of what E.O. Wilson calls consilience, a reintegration after the enlightenment of human knowledge?
I'm certainly calling for a reintegration of the three axes, which I believe we have split into. The humanities or humanism axis, the technology axis, which is now the biggest because this is going to be the century of technology, and the faith or spiritual axis.
Hmm. This is a big subject. I'm glad you mentioned it. I feel a huge convergence happening at all kinds of levels of learning on these scales. It seems to me it's the one great thread of many connection programs in the past year, an eagerness to sort of reintegrate around these questions.
I agree, and I think it'll become even more pressing as we move into this, the century of technology, because in some ways technology has replaced spiritualism, which was the guiding force in the earlier millennium. And as we do this, I think the tension will be increased, and we'll have to reconcile the three.
Richard Landis is on the line, runs the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University. Was it Y2K who got your phone line a moment ago, Richard?
No. It was my own incompetence.
Ah. Human inadequacy. I have to just sort of say, Richard, Chicken Little, take
you
a bow here.
Do you?
No, I mean, I want to say if I met Chicken Little on the Y2K issue and the millennial issue, it was you.
Well, I like to think of myself as a responsible rooster on that rather than a Chicken Little, but okay. I mean, one of the problems with it is that the debate really, I think one of your guests spoke about the attraction to apocalyptic thinking, and there's no question that at least in 97, 98, this was one of the major elements of what was going on, and a lot of that quieted down, but essentially the debate got framed in terms of either it's going to be a 7 to 9 on the scale or it's going to be a 1 to 3, and that middle range was what tended not to be addressed. So in that sense, I think, you know, if you saw me as a Chicken Little, I think that's partly because in your mind it was framed as all or nothing.
You can hear me? By the time we get reconnected, we'll probably be done.
What I'm thinking, Richard, and I should just introduce you a little more more broadly, you had a medieval historical interest in the first millennium,
right?
And it seemed to be your general theory that there's a sort of deep tide in human psychology that was going to rise up into some sort of explosive wave of paranoia, fear, mass mobilization. For you, it seemed to me Y2K was the hook on which sort of a more primal dread mm-hmm. would fasten and start a run on the banks, maybe on the bankers, maybe on any kind of villain, ethnic or religious or whatever would be convenient. But the net of it is still, it didn't happen. We don't see any terrorist move. We don't see any public agitation.
Right.
And there wasn't a hook, and there wasn't anything to hang on it either.
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple of things here. First of all, we're following a lot more than just, there's an irony in our use of the term doomsday, because in Old English, doomsday means judgment day. It doesn't mean catastrophe. And in a sense, if you associate doomsday with a catastrophe, it's a reflection, at least unconscious, of what you might call a bad conscience, which is when judgment day comes, you're going to, you know, it's going to be disastrous. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, one of the things that we were following was quite not just the sort of end of the world people who were predicting catastrophes. And, you know, somebody like Jerry Falwell, I think, is a good case. Somebody who in the summer of 98 had a tape associating Y2K with the end of the world and then withdrew that tape. And you can say, well, he's just covering his you know what. On the other hand, you can say he's being responsible. But I think the major point that I'd make in terms of this stuff is that there are really two, you know, there's also the consilience, the sort of vision of a global community, and I think Y2K definitely contributed to that. I mean, I consider the fact that we had Russian specialists in our most secret military observation posts on December 31st to be an extraordinary development in the global community. So I'm not sure, and the other point point is that the religious stuff that I was looking at as a historian, or shall I say the millennial aspects that I was looking at as a historian because I was interested in the impact of the zeros, you know, that story certainly isn't over yet. We've got not only 2000 but 2001, and the religious people backed off certainly of December 31st in the course of this year. One of the things we know about apocalyptic expectations is, again, as your guest, one of your guests pointed out, this is something that's very attractive to some people, not to all people. In fact, most people don't like it. But, you know, these people don't just give up because they've been disappointed. So, you know, I would say it's a little early to say the story's over. And I know plenty of people in the Y2K community who say, you know, we need at least a couple of months to see whether that 3 to 6 range as opposed to the 7 to 9 range plays out.
How long is the lease at the Center for Millennial Studies?
Well, we're in great shape because one of the most important aspects of apocalyptic expectation is that throughout history, it's always been wrong. And so the key element, wrong, as I never cease to point out, does not mean inconsequential. And so one of the things that we study here is disappointment. So disappointment, you know, the study of disappointment is certainly going to be an interesting thing to follow. One of the things I want to do now is start interviewing the people who really, the Y2K specialists, who really thought that it was going to be serious. And to be honest, I thought it was going to be serious. I'll admit that I'm, first of all, enormously relieved that it wasn't serious, but also, you know, I'll admit I was surprised. On the other hand, one of the things that I think I noted, and I think this is going to be important in the future, is, first of all, that the people who took Y2K seriously, some of them were chicken littles and really did even potentially destructive things. Other people, some of the most interesting thinking about the global community came from people who said, look, this is the most expensive peacetime era in the history of the world. This is the first global technological project that's been taken on by everybody at the same time. So this really sort of introduces the next millennium as a global millennium.
I have a question for Richard. Richard, you said there were the 3 to 6s who said it wouldn't be too bad, and the 7 to 9s who were kind of...
Well, no, there's the 1 to 3s who said... It's not
gonna 1 to 3s, okay. Right. My sense is that there were hardly any 1 to 3s, at least reading the newspapers and listening to the media, and there were 99% 7 to 9s. Is that your sense, too, or are we off?
No, I think you're off there. I mean, the way that I sensed it, and I checked this with a number of people who watched it even more closely than I did, was that 98 was a year in which the roosters tended to dominate, and 99 unquestionably was a year in which the owls dominated. The people who said it's not going to be that serious, most of the articles that ran in 99 played it down so strongly that you actually had people like Jerry Falwell backing off, partly because he was getting pressure from his own constituency, his fellow pastors, saying, look, you know, you're going to give us a bad reputation here.
Yeah, I think you're right about the timing. I was referring to 98, when everybody seemed to be on the 7 to 9. One of the interesting phenomena, Chris, that we may want to touch on is what happened during the end of 99. In the last 60 to 90 days, I noticed a tremendous backpedaling as people from all corners started backpedaling and saying, well, it's not going to be that catastrophic. So I wonder what kind of human nature or other event caused that.
I don't know. It beats me. Richard Landis, thank you. Watts Wacker, do you know what accounts for the... I mean, I like that image of having to find a million needles in all of the Rocky Mountains. I think maybe they counted up their needles and they had 900 and some thousand and they figured, hey, we're doing okay. We're going to make it.
Well, Christopher, I think the point that Richard made and that Michael reinforced is that part of the human condition is the need for juxtaposition of foils against which to play your thoughts. You know, one of the issues that goes around the world today is, with no more evil empire, where do you put your points of evil against? And the Y2K thing became kind of an iconic representation of some of that. And when I listened to Richard, what he made me really think about is how the Europeans talk about futuring. They don't call it, you know, being a futurist. They call it being a futurologist. And like Michael's a technologist. And the ology ending, whether it's bio biology or mythology or technology or futurology is and its influence on society.
Hmm.
And so it's the study of the future and its influence on what we do today. And there is great ramification from Y2K in how we are going to go about entering this new century, decade, millennium, year, whatever, whichever, pick whichever one you want. It's all iconic. But there was symbolism that we had made it to a new threshold.
Hmm.
And I do believe we started ushering in the future on a note of globalism.
I think you're probably right. Well said. 1-800-423-8255. And thanks again to Richard Landis from the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University. Jeremy is calling from a car phone.
Hi.
Hello, Jeremy.
Hi. It's nice to be with you. I just wanted to let you know that there were three different points. The first point was, remember what happened to Jonah, the disappointed prophet? He told the people in Nineveh that there was going to be a problem unless they repented. They repented, and then he was disappointed because they didn't get the disaster they so deserved. That's my first point.
Hmm.
The second point was, all the dates that are important haven't happened yet. The last day of the month of February is the 29th in this century. So we're going to have to see what happens then. And also on March 1st. During December 31st evening, I was spending a lot of time trying to convince people not to try wild and crazy things that they had never tried before on a Friday evening on that particular time. In other words, the fact that everybody was there ready to field Y2K problems could have created those very problems because of the fact that there were problems already in the software that had never been exercised, that people were going to try to do something completely different. So that's all I had to say.
We need a guy like you at every party, Jeremy, telling people not to do those wild and crazy things. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. The Y2K connection. Zahid is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Zahid. Welcome.
No, this is Eric.
I beg your pardon.
From
sorry.
Marshfield.
Sorry.
I've been following the conversation. I agree that a lot of the talk about Y2K was overstated. At the same time, I think to just say, oh, nothing happened, nothing was going to happen, was rather foolish. Now, I'm a journalist who covers technology and business a lot. And I'll tell you, I talked with a lot of CIOs at hospitals and businesses and the like who had uncovered major problems. And if it hadn't been for all the hype, they wouldn't have been looking.
For example?
For example, a hospital, they had their first batch of medicine that was had an expiration date in the year 2000. They entered it into their pharmacy system, and it froze the entire pharmacy system.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't deliver a single bit of medicine.
Well, you know, there seems to me it's just another example of a way in which the system has been searched, tested, found,
you know,
improved, and found ready. And,
right.
And I think that's what Michael and Watts are both saying, is that we've all been a little more sort of bonded with our technology.
Yeah, and I think if I may say to Eric, I agree with you, Eric. I don't think we should call it foolish. It wasn't foolish. It was a good thing that we did. One other factor that gave me a little confidence was the fact that we have a huge office workforce around the world. It's over 150 million people. And these people, wearing, if you wish, green eye shades, were not going to sit still while the bug was causing ugliness of various sorts. Mm-hmm. They could always intervene and manually, perhaps not very efficiently, but manually correct the error. So that was yet another safety valve, if you wish, in this problem. But you're right. We shouldn't call it a silly exercise.
Eric, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Zahid is on the line.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome. Sorry.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I enjoy your show every time. Because my question is like, see, I'm from one of those countries, they call it least developed countries, like Bangladesh.
Okay.
So, I'm not gonna call this Y2K whole issue is in the media hype, but my question is like, the countries like mine, those who cannot go for like expensive testers. And I know for a fact, talking to my parents and all over, I mean, a lot of people back in my country, that and there was not much of a preparation regarding this Y2K at all. And how these countries get away with this when we spend more than $100 billion down here in USA? What should be the reason, or what should be the answer behind that?
Hello, Zahid. This is Michael.
Hi.
Hi. I had an interesting exercise in calling the Bangladeshi embassy to find out what percentage of the Bangladeshi economy is devoted to computer hardware and software. I had done the same kind of research in the U.S. and found that the U.S. spends 10% of its economy on computers and software. Germany and Japan spend the same, 10%. So the question is, a poor country like yours,
yeah,
how much did it spend? It took me a long time to find it out, but I finally did. It was less than 0.1% of your economy goes to computer hardware and software. That means that you devote, on a per capita basis, about 100 times less for computer equipment. So in a way, you might say the problem would be 100 times smaller in a country like yours, because you've had so much less in computing. That's an unfortunate fact. And I think what this brings up is something I'd like to say. We call it the World Wide Web. And I think it's a bit ironic, because it interconnects only 2% of the population of the world. And countries like Bangladesh and India and the whole Indian subcontinent and Africa are completely excluded from this interconnection. So as we face the brave new world, and as we prepare for wonderful things with technology in the 21st century, we should keep in mind that unless and until all the people get connected, mm-hmm, we really won't be there.
So thank you. Watch Marker.
If I can add to that too, Michael, you know, the comment about how does a nation get away with not having prepared itself is partly answered in the role of nations to the future, too. IBM and Microsoft preparing for this actually perhaps makes more sense than a nation in its own right doing it on its own, particularly one that isn't as technologically driven for its economic gain as the United States would be. And so this may be the first bellwether of the corporations taking on what used to be more of a role of a nation.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Y2K connection. Jane is on the line.
Oh, hi, Chris.
Welcome, Jane.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if anyone has a good recipe for canned peas and canned green beans. And
how much you got?
I've got flour. I've got all kinds of dry goods, lots of water. We even have potassium iodide in case Seabrook melted down.
What kind of weapons have you got?
We're from the West, so it's not unusual for Westerners to have rifles and shotguns. So we did get ammunition. We had our plane. We have a small plane. We had it fueled and ready to fly to Montana or someplace.
Did you have a place to land?
Well, we would have found one. We got a lot of ways to find that information, but you know, we're pretty reasonable people. We're well educated, and we read well, and we watch what's going on.
You know a lot about explosives, probably.
No, actually, probably not.
I'm just teasing, just joking.
We just, when we watch and we hear the officials and the legislature saying, don't worry, everything's going to be fine, but then we hear that they're going to be staying in bunkers, or the space shuttle, we think everything's fine with NASA, but we better not send the space shuttle up just in case it can't come down or something. And I think it's part of, I don't know, I'm glad we were prepared, but now I have to think of what to do with all this stuff.
Watchwacker, welcome this good woman, Jane, to a calm, peaceful, happy, homey 21st century here.
You know, it's funny. I was on the phone yesterday to a friend of mine in Belgrade, Montana, and he did tell me that the first airport that you would have wanted to land at would have been next to the Ted Kaczynski Museum. The celebration in Montana was like he had never seen, and this is a guy who never went through the fourth grade, but has built his own website and is as wired as anybody I know in his business. And so I asked him in preparation for this, Christopher, what he thought, given that he lives in one of the wild wests of the future. And he said he was quite surprised at how there was not as much of a call to the, you know, supreme action of the dark side coming as he would have expected. And I think that what Jane is demonstrating is that we saw everybody at all ends of the spectrum, and that we should continue to anticipate more extremism on both sides of any fulcrum as we move forth into the beginning.
Thank goodness we're past it. Jane, just eat one can of peas a day. It'll go faster than you could have imagined. Watts Wacker, author of The 500-Year Delta, thank you for joining us. Michael Dutouzos from the MIT Computer Lab, thank you for joining us. And to all the callers and the listeners, happy Y2K. I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Goldsmiths 3, creators of contemporary handcrafted jewelry and precious metals and rare gems. For the complete picture, goldsmiths3.com. And by Hutchins, Wheeler, and Dittmar, counselors at law, more than 150 years of dedication and service to its clients.
PRI. Public Radio International. From Boston.